Hi, I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call, a show created at KALW with the support of listeners like you. As you listen to the programming you value, give your support to KALW's September campaign. Join us for the first time or renew your membership at KALW.org. Thank you. Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In his new book, America's War for the Greater Middle East, today's guest, military historian Andrew Basevich, writes, quote, "Beginning in 1980, United States forces ventured into the Greater Middle East to reassure, warn, intimidate, suppress, pacify, rescue, liberate, eliminate, and transform. They bombed, raided, invaded, occupied, and worked through proxies of various stripes. Subsequent upheavals have swept through the region in waves. Revolutions and counter-revolutions, episodes of terror and counter-terror, grotesque barbarism, and vast suffering. Through it all, a succession of American leaders, Republican and Democrat, calculating and naive, has persisted in the belief that the determined exercise of U.S. military power will somehow put things right. None have seen their hopes fulfilled." End quote. Andrew Basevich believes that whether the United States is able to shape the greater Middle East will matter less than whether it can reshape itself, restoring effectiveness to self-government, providing for sustainable and equitable prosperity. He says that the wars will end when the American people get fed up. Today, we are going to speak with Andrew Basevich about what it will take for the United States to change its destructive policies in the Middle East. What role has the American public and the media played in perpetuating the cycle of war and violence in that region? Andrew Basevich is a retired professor of international relations and history at Boston University and a leading advocate of a non-interventionist approach to U.S. foreign policy. He is the author of a dozen books, including his most recent, America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. He served in the Army for 23 years, and he joins us from the studios of WGBH in Boston. Hi, Andrew. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks very much.
Well, it's great to have you. I want to ask you about an op-ed you recently wrote in the Boston Globe about the Commander-in-Chief Forum. This was an event by NBC at the aircraft carrier, the USS Intrepid in New York. And Matt Lauer interviewed Hillary Clinton. You were there. Many people have attacked Matt Lauer for doing a pretty bad job of asking questions. He spent more than a third of his time with Hillary Clinton on her email server, and he let Donald Trump off with pretty soft questions, not much fact-checking. You wrote in this piece, "It was not journalism, it did not inform, and if NBC's forum offers a preview of the upcoming presidential debates, then we're in trouble." What was your experience like? Why did you get invited?
In retrospect, I'm not sure why I got invited. The event, there was an hour-long so-called forum, which was Lauer interviewing in succession Hillary Clinton and then Donald Trump. Following that hour, the Rachel Maddow show was on MSNBC, and I was invited to come down from Boston to participate in that show. I didn't have a clear understanding of what my role would be prior to arriving. It turned out that what my role was frankly, almost non-existent. The Maddow Hour was primarily devoted to an interaction with younger, mostly younger veterans who were also attending, and that was fine. I was part of a small panel of so-called experts, and mostly we just sat there and watched. Being witness, however, was useful for me in this sense, is that in that it offered me a close-up chance to understand the way that the mainstream media, in my judgment, tends to trivialize politics. Because, as you suggested in your lead-in there, the questions posed by Lauer in the first hour left much to be desired. And I personally felt that the conversation in the second hour was a missed opportunity. We could have really addressed some serious questions, and we didn't.
You've been on this show before talking about the foreign policy of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Because we didn't get much substance from this conversation. Give us your assessment, first off, of Hillary Clinton. I mean, so much attention right now is on her health, but these issues obviously are so, so important. Talk a little bit, I mean, she's got a big track record on U.S. foreign policy. Talk a little bit about what you think her foreign policy would look like if she becomes president.
Well, Secretary Clinton is a very smart person, a very seasoned operator in Washington, politician, office holder. She has seen a lot of the world. My sense, however, is that she lacks creativity. She still seems to buy into a set of assumptions that, in my view, came into existence at the end of the Cold War. And if you wanted to summarize those assumptions in one phrase, it would be America as the indispensable nation, a phrase that suggests primacy. And there was a lot of talk right after the Cold War of America as the sole superpower, as the global hegemon. I thought that talk was misplaced when it seemed to suggest fresh ideas. I think it's utterly obsolete at the present moment, and I don't get a sense that she has adjusted her thinking about U.S. foreign policy to take into account all of the changes that have occurred in the 3.5 decades or so since the Cold War did end.
And what are your thoughts on the various articles that have come out recently calling Hillary Clinton a hawk? There was a lengthy New York Times Magazine piece that looked at that. A lot of people say that she's much more hawkish than President Obama. How will that play out on the ground?
Well, it remains to be seen, but I mean, I think that the charge is a pretty accurate one. Based on her tenure as both a U.S. senator and as a Secretary of State, she does appear to have very considerable confidence in the effectiveness of U.S. military power, confidence in the ability of policymakers to put that armed might to work. During her tenure as Secretary of State, the intervention in Libya that she strongly supported, I think, is a very good example of where her inclinations point. For someone like myself, that intervention in Libya and the consequences that ensued from it give a very good example of why someone might be wary of Hillary Clinton becoming a commander-in-chief. And I say that by no means suggesting that Donald Trump would be a preferable alternative.
We'll get to Trump in just a minute, but Hillary Clinton has said she will never, ever send U.S. ground troops to Iraq. You point out that several thousand soldiers are actually in that country directly and indirectly in combat operations. I would guess that maybe a lot of Americans don't really know that. We don't talk about that very much.
I think that's probably true. We Americans tend to pay attention to the wars that we're involved in when there are substantial American casualties. We don't pay much attention to casualties that are not Americans. We don't pay much attention even to how many American dollars are being expended in support of wars. One of the, I think, ironic results of the Obama approach to managing our wars is that he hasn't been any more successful in the prosecution of wars than George W. Bush, but he has succeeded in reducing very significantly the number of Americans who are being killed. And that has permitted Americans, encouraged Americans in a way, to tune the wars out. And therefore, Hillary Clinton can say what she said, apparently oblivious to the fact that there are several thousand American soldiers on the ground in Iraq today, in harm's way, and yet she can get away with it because most Americans apparently think that the Iraq war has ended,
right,
when it hasn't.
Do we know anything about Hillary Clinton's drone policy?
I have not seen her talk about that a lot. My impression is, however, that she's generally in support of the drone gambit that has been such an important feature of the Obama administration's approach to managing American wars. I haven't seen anything that would suggest that she would back away from the emphasis on drones. One of the things I was suggesting in that column you referred to as an example of the sort of question that mm-hmm. ought to be asked of the candidates is, please measure, please compare for us the costs and benefits of using drones to assassinate people. This has become a signature of the American way of war, and I think that especially in a presidential campaign, we really ought to hear more of an evaluation of whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. Mm.
What about Donald Trump? He says he has some secret plan to defeat ISIS, and it'll come out in time. I mean, he basically said, make America great again at this event. Really didn't give much concrete information. But what are your thoughts based on the little information we do have about his foreign policy?
Well, I think more than what we have on his foreign policy is what we're what we are learning about his temperament, and his thought processes, such as they are, and what we're learning, I think, is that he is a person with a very short attention span. He's not particularly interested in ideas. There's very little evidence that he reads seriously. He does not seem to be a person who is inclined to consult broadly with a variety of people who might offer different views for him to chew on. He tends to rely on a very small circle of advisors, giving preference to his own children, and he shoots from the hip. He seems to say the first thing that comes out of his mouth, and on each one of those points, it seems to me, he's not qualified to be the commander-in-chief.
What do you make of him and the way the media are covering him? Specifically, on Friday night, he said that he would attack Iran if their sailors made improper gestures toward the U.S. Navy. He got applause and chants of USA for about 30 seconds straight. What do you make of that?
I make of that standard operating procedure for Donald Trump. This hyper-nationalistic, chest-thumping rhetoric that does not take into account both the complexity of what's going on in the Persian Gulf between U.S. naval forces and Iranian naval forces, and certainly doesn't take into account the possibility of exceedingly negative consequences were there to be a shooting war between the United States and Iran over some trivial little confrontation in the Gulf.
Today, I'm speaking with Andrew Bacevich, retired professor of history and international relations at Boston University. His latest book is America's War for the Greater Middle East. Andrew, before we dive in and talk about your book, I want to ask you how you came to this point in your life. You're a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy. You served for 23 years as an officer in the United States Army. You taught at West Point. How did you get to this point? You're a very big critic of U.S. foreign policy. What's really shaped your views?
Well, I guess that by upbringing and education, particularly the time I spent at the U.S. Military Academy, I became imbued with a fairly specific worldview and a sense of the role that the United States was supposed to play. This was a process of formation that happened in the context of the Cold War, which I, as a young person, mistakenly came to see as a fairly simple period. But when I got out of the Army and was able to distance myself from that institution and had the great good fortune of being able to become an academic, availing myself to the opportunity to begin to to write more frequently, my views evolved. And in particular, I think my views evolved because when the Cold War ended, it didn't have the effect on U.S. policy that I had fancied that it might. When I was young, I thought, as everybody thought, that the Cold War was going to go on forever. And when the Cold War actually did end, I fancied that the United States was now going to become something of a normal nation. It was going to behave more prudently. It was going to give up on its global military aspirations. In fact, the effect of ending the Cold War was that the United States became more militaristic, more interventionist, more hubristic, and that struck me as very much at odds with the interests of the country as a whole, and I began then to ask questions about what exactly is it that makes the United States do what it does on the world stage. And I came to, in my 40s and my 50s, came to radically different conclusions in comparison to what I believed when I was a teenager or when I was in my 20s.
And your book details the 35-year history of U.S. foreign policy and military involvement in the Middle East. You ask a lot of the questions you just raised there. You include a map in the beginning of your book that shows the massive U.S. military footprint since 1980. Why is 1980 so pivotal in understanding the catastrophic consequences of U.S. military involvement in that region?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote the book for a number of reasons. One of them is to try to make the point that what most Americans refer to as the war on terrorism, dating from 9/11, that's the wrong term. That our military involvement predates 9/11 by a couple of decades, and I choose 1980 as the start point for the narrative, because that's when Jimmy Carter promulgated the Carter Doctrine, and the promulgation of the Carter Doctrine triggered the militarization of U.S. policy across much of the Islamic world. Americans have by now forgotten that prior to 1980, the Pentagon treated the Middle East as an afterthought. You know, we had lots of forces ready to fight in Western Europe. We had forces geared up to fight in East Asia. Those were contingencies that derived from the Cold War. We did not have significant forces. We did not have war plans. We did not have bases that would permit any significant U.S. military intervention, not only in the Persian Gulf, but anywhere else in the greater Middle East. And beginning in 1980, that changes. So 1980 initiates a pattern of military intervention that has continued since, and indeed in many respects has grown in scope, so that today in 2016 we've got forces as far as Afghanistan in the east and throughout the large parts of Africa in the west, and all of this huge story, this important story, this story of military failure dates from 1980.
And in your book, you write about the Carter Doctrine in 1980 and Jimmy Carter's State of the Union address. He said, quote, "An attempt by any outside force to gain control of the Persian Gulf region will be regarded as an assault on the vital interest of the United States of America. And as such, an assault will be repelled by any means necessary, including military force." End quote. So in other words, Jimmy Carter said that the United States is now a place that the U.S. considers worth fighting for. Why did he come to that conclusion?
Well, in a narrow or cynical sense, it's because he was hoping to win re-election in November of 1980, and he knew he was facing a very, very tough re-election fight. He knew that because he was viewed as weak, because the economy was performing poorly, because he was being widely criticized for what were perceived to be two massive foreign policy failures. On the one hand, the Iranian Revolution, which overthrew the Shah, previously an American ally. On the other hand, the Soviet incursion into Afghanistan, which seemed to suggest that the Soviets were embarking upon a new phase of of imperial expansionism. And so the Carter Doctrine was a way for Carter to look tough. We also have to recall that this occurred in a context at the end of a decade when the United States had twice suffered so-called oil shocks. Americans were acutely sensitive to the extent to which the American way of life at that point was dependent upon access to foreign oil. So in a sort of a narrow sense, the war for the greater Middle East began as a war for oil. And of course, here we are 36 years later, and all that looks pretty ironic because 36 years later, the American way of life may still be dependent, like it or not, on access to oil and natural gas, but we don't need to get it from the Persian Gulf. We have plenty of it in the Western Hemisphere.
Andrew Bacevich is author of America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. He starts his book by looking at what happened in 1980. We were just talking about the Carter Doctrine. And Andrew, many say that the Carter Doctrine is really based on the Truman Doctrine, which effectively reoriented U.S. foreign policy away from its stance of withdrawal from regional conflicts not directly involving the United States to one of intervention in faraway conflicts. Can you also talk about that?
Yeah, I think the comparison is a fair one. Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was the national security advisor to President Carter at the time, explicitly said that the intent of the Carter Doctrine was to make a statement comparable to the Truman Doctrine. And we need to remind ourselves that one of the problems with the Truman Doctrine is that it was open-ended. It did not indicate any limits. So the Truman Doctrine, when Truman enunciated the Truman Doctrine, the particular focus of concern was the perception of a communist threat to Greece and Turkey. And the Truman Doctrine really began as a commitment to support the Greek and Turkish governments that seemed to be vulnerable to subversion. But when you fast forward about a decade and a half to the administrations of John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, lo and behold, the Truman Doctrine becomes part of the rationale for the U.S. military intervention in Vietnam and all the bad stuff that came as a consequence of that. So something of the same, I think, is true with regard to the Carter Doctrine. It begins as a statement to defend the Persian Gulf, but the militarization of U.S. policy that then ensues over subsequent decades carries the United States military into places that are far, far beyond the Persian Gulf, and places where there frankly are no important strategic interests that are worth fighting for.
Today we are speaking with Andrew Bacevich, a military historian who served in the Army for 23 years. His latest book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. As he says, a lot of people think that what the U.S. is doing in the Middle East began right after 9/11. Obviously, that's not the case. Andrew Bacevich goes back to 1980 and writes about what has happened since. He writes in his book, "As an American who cares deeply about the fate of his country, I should state plainly my own assessment of this ongoing war, now well into its fourth decade. We have not won it. We are not winning it. Simply trying harder is unlikely to produce a different outcome. Some may consider this history premature, yet only be remembering and confronting what we have largely chosen to disregard will Americans be able to choose a different course." He says this will stop only when the American people get fed up. Today, we are speaking with military historian Andrew Bacevich about his new book, America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Andrew has been on book tour, traveling around the country, talking about his book, and he says he is always asked the same question. What should we do about ISIS? This is one of the main questions that reporters are also asking the candidates. But Andrew says this is the wrong question. The questions we should be asking are, does waging war make sense? If not, why are we here? And how did we get to where we are today? So if you have any questions or comments for Andrew Bacevich about these issues, we'd love to hear from you. I mean, in some ways, this is so overwhelming. Everywhere you look is just full of violence. The refugee crisis is just horrific. NPR had two really good stories about that this morning. So what questions or comments do you have about Andrew Bacevich? He's got so much experience with these issues. He served for 23 years as an officer in the United States Army, and he's a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy, retired professor of history and international relations at Boston University. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet at Your Call Radio. And Andrew, since we don't really spend much time talking about history, which is so, so important in the national dialogue, is there anything that you want to tell us about that grabbed your attention when you were doing your research about, you know, say the late 70s, early 80s? Did anything really stand out for you?
Well, I think that many things stand out. One of them was the durability of the Cold War worldview. You know, we still get a sense of that today in much of the discussion about Russia and U.S. relationship with Russia. It's as if the Cold War never ended. And I took from that, I came to some greater understanding of the difficulty, and I think particularly the difficulty that Washington has, and I use the term really to refer to our foreign policy elite, the difficulty that Washington has in adapting its mindset in a time of rapidly changing conditions. Actually, I'm repeating myself to some degree when I made that comment earlier, because I think Hillary Clinton, in many respects, embodies this difficulty. So when we are in moments of great change, as I believe we are today, it becomes all the more important to challenge that which we all think we know, especially because that which we all think we know can frequently turn out to be obsolete and a bit of a problem when it comes to thinking clearly about the challenges that we're dealing with.
And talk a little bit about how the Carter Doctrine was expanded in the decades after the Carter administration.
Well, I mean, and to emphasize, this is a project that's been very much a bipartisan project, a project that really every president since Jimmy Carter in one way or another bought into. I mean, we could begin with Ronald Reagan, who during his time in office, just with regard to the greater Middle East, sent American peacekeepers into Lebanon, fancying that the presence in Lebanon, torn by civil war, occupied by both Israeli and Syrian forces, Reagan fancied that a reinforced Marine task force would somehow or other bring peace to that badly divided land. The result, of course, was the Beirut bombing of October 1983, in which 241 Americans were killed to no purpose whatsoever, with the effect of, in many respects, communicating to other parties, not least of all Osama bin Laden, that the United States was weak and would not stand up under sustained pressure. Take another Reagan episode of intervening, totally forgotten, I think, intervening on behalf of Saddam Hussein in the war of between Iran and Iraq that lasted from 1980 to 1988. This had little to do with Persian Gulf oil. It had a lot to do with Reagan's conviction that the Iranian Revolution somehow posed a threat to regional stability. So we threw in with, we supported Saddam Hussein and helped Saddam Hussein avoid a defeat at the hands of Iran when that war ended in 1988. I think the larger point to make here, however, is that as we survey this chronology of events from one administration to the next, we see, the conviction that somehow or other the application of American military power is going to set things right, and B, really the absence of any overarching sense of exactly how that's going to come to be, meaning there really is no strategy. There are moments when there may be glimmerings of a strategy, and here I think I would cite George Herbert Walker Bush and the intervention in the second Iraq War. That's the war of 1990-91 when Saddam Hussein has become the enemy. But on balance, there has been a huge gap between the level of U.S. military effort in the region and a sort of an undergirding coherent sense of purpose. And that has really, I think, been a recurring theme.
Andrew Bacevich is author of America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Kit in Tiburon. Hi, Kit. Welcome to the show.
Hi. My question is, how is what's happening in the Middle East comparable to, better or worse than, how Vietnam ended up? And my specific question is, isn't it legitimate to try to avoid having failed states and prop up democratic governments with at least a minimum amount of force to maintain their stability, unlike Vietnam that we abandoned at the end?
Thanks, Kit.
Well, I understand the core of the question to be, isn't it a good thing to try to prop up states lest they become failed states? And it is. There's no question about it. Unfortunately, the record of U.S. military intervention in the region suggests that U.S. military action contributes to the creation of failed states. It seems to me there's no question that one of the results of the George W. Bush invasion of Iraq in 2003 was to shatter Iraq. Efforts to put Iraq back together, and that was an endeavor that we pursued until 2011, simply did not work, and the evidence is in front of us to behold, an Iraq that is besieged by the forces of the Islamic State. But that's not the only example. We have the example of Libya. The Obama administration's 2011 intervention there intended to prevent Muammar Gaddafi from committing acts of genocide, at least that was the advertised purpose, and there too. The apparent success, we got rid of Gaddafi, just as we had gotten rid of Saddam Hussein back in 2003, nonetheless leaves Libya as a failed state. We have a variation of the theme in Somalia, which already was a failed state when George Herbert Walker Bush ordered the U.S. intervene in 1992, that intervention inherited by Clinton. Clinton believing that we had the capacity to nation build in Somalia, and that belief culminating in the famous Mogadishu firefight of October 1993, an American failure, and following the American withdrawal, Somalia returned to the status of failed state. So if somebody could make the case to me that U.S. military action helped to bring stability to nation states, leading toward a restabilization of the region, I might be in favor of it. But all of the evidence of the past several decades points in the opposite direction.
You also point out that ISIS would not exist today had the United States not invaded Iraq in 2003.
I don't think the opinion is original with me, but the evidence seems pretty clear. We could spend the rest of the hour talking about what a terrible guy Saddam Hussein was, and he was a terrible guy. But the fact of the matter is that as long as he wielded authority in Baghdad, there was no al-Qaeda in Iraq. There was no such thing as ISIS. It was the removal of Saddam Hussein with the expectation, false expectation, the expectation that we could then put in place a new Iraqi order. It was the logic of the George W. Bush administration. But that new order, in a meaningful sense, never took root, and therefore the opening was present for first Al-Qaeda in Iraq and then ISIS to insert themselves into this circumstance with terrible consequences.
The presidential candidates often say, elect me and I'll destroy ISIS. You say, Andrew, that on your book tour, one of the main questions that you are asked is, what should the U.S. do about ISIS? Everybody's asking you about ISIS.
And in some respects, the point of my book is to try to say, it's not that that's not a worthy question. It's a good question to ask to those who aspire to be the next president. But it seems to me there are more important questions, and the more important questions would include things like, what lessons do you, Secretary Clinton, Mr. Trump, take from this 3.5 decades of U.S. military interventionism in the region that was supposed to bring order or spread democracy or somehow produce some kind of a positive outcome? And what do you make of this now quite long chapter in U.S. military history? And I think that that question, in fact, should take priority over the question of what are you going to do about ISIS. And I say that in part because, you know, if we could wave our magic wand and tomorrow ISIS would disappear, by no means does that mean that the region would once again return to any kind of a semblance of a stable situation. ISIS is not the problem. ISIS is actually a symptom of the problem. And the problem is one that very few people in Washington are even willing to discuss. Certainly neither of the two presidential candidates will discuss in any detail.
Well, thank you for calling in, Kit. Let's go next to Nancy in San Francisco. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Just a quick question. Would you consider that one diplomatic approach to the area might be more of a historical perspective, perhaps since World War I, that the mistrust of the Western world sort of affects even today our relationship with the Middle East?
Yes, I think it's very important to have that historical perspective. I mean, I'd maybe use somewhat different words than you used, but we should remember that what we call the Middle East today, the set of nations and boundaries, is the creation of European imperialists who used World War I as a pretext for dismantling the Ottoman Empire, believing that they could create a new Middle East that would serve the purposes not of the people who live there, but would serve the purposes, the imperial ambitions of countries like Great Britain and France. It would be unfair to say that European arrogance and irresponsibility provides a complete explanation for the problems that we face today. It would be fair to say that that's one very important explanation. And so, yes, there are grievances against the West that predate the grievances present today targeting the United States. But, of course, the United States has long advertised itself as the principal power, the leading power in the West. So history is crucially important. And I think more than anything else, what history tells us is don't delude yourself into thinking that there are simple solutions that can be imposed by outside powers. And that may seem like a self-evident proposition, but it was the conviction that we as an outside power could impose a solution neatly and quickly that provided the rationale for the George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq in 2003. That was supposed to be the first step in their minds in what would become then a broader transformation of the region that would ultimately eliminate the sources of violent Islamic radicalism. And they got that dead wrong, and we are stuck with the consequences of that error.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for calling, Nancy. We have a related question from Jack in Los Altos. Hi, Jack.
Hi. I've enjoyed listening to your guest. My question is, we've just commemorated the loss of lives on 9/11, but shouldn't we take a moment and mourn the loss of tens of thousands of lives in Laos, the secret war, nine-year war in Laos, Cambodia? Shouldn't we offer massive reparations to all those poor people, innocent civilians that were killed, and build Holocaust museums in New York or Washington? And that would be an impediment to further misadventures, military misadventures?
Well, perhaps we should do some... what we ought to, as a people, to be far more aware than we are of what the prior misuse of American military power has yielded. And certainly the Vietnam War and the war waged on Vietnam's neighbors, often secretly and very brutally, should figure. Now, that doesn't mean that all wars are wrong and misguided. It doesn't mean that the United States represents evil, and that wherever we go in the world, we do evil things. But there is an absence of historical awareness and an unwillingness to submit ourselves to the same sort of judgments that we insist that other nations and other peoples should accept. And that unwillingness then constitutes an obstacle to learning and makes it all that much more difficult for those who aspire to positions of political leadership to make a turn away from past mistakes in the direction of policies that arguably at least could be more enlightened. I mean, one of the things that just impresses me is how shallow the discussion of U.S. policy in the greater Middle East tends to be, and how difficult it is for anybody aspiring to positions of national prominence to acknowledge what, again, at least to my mind, seems to be self-evident, and that is that U.S. military efforts in this part of the world have simply failed, and indeed, more often than not, have had negative consequences, and therefore we ought to try something different. But that conversation simply doesn't happen.
Andrew, how do you take on the institutions that benefit from the wars that drag on and on? I mean, I'm talking about the companies that receive massive profits from contracts, the jobs across the country, campaign contributions. In your book, you point out that during the 8 years of the Bush presidency, U.S. military spending, easily the highest in the world, more than doubled from $300 billion to $700 billion. The Atlantic is out with a new piece saying that the estimated cost of America's post-9/11 wars is $5 trillion and counting. How do you take on these very strong institutions?
Yeah, and we should give credit on that Atlantic piece. We should give credit to the researchers who actually came up with the calculations, and that's the something called the Costs of War Project at Brown University. Those scholars there have been doing yeoman work for quite years now in trying to track casualties and track costs. But to your question, I mean, I think the answer, Eisenhower gave us the answer. In his farewell address, the farewell address in which he called the attention of the American people to the existence of what he called the military-industrial complex. And if you go back and look at that speech, he said that the only solution is to have a people who are educated and aware, who are paying attention, who insist upon accountability. The Pentagon is not going to reform itself. The defense contractors are not going to advocate policies that are going to lead to a reduction in U.S. military spending. So it is up to the American people to take cognizance of what our policies have yielded in moral terms, but also in practical terms. You know, are we making ourselves more secure? Are we making the best use of the limited resources that we have available to us? Are the choices we make to spend, Pentagon's still getting $600 billion a year, the choices we make in prioritizing our national wealth, do those in fact contribute to the well-being of the American people? Do they contribute to making the world a safer and more peaceful place? And these first-order questions somehow simply don't get asked. And I think, to circle all the way back to the beginning of the program, one of the reasons that they don't get asked is because the conversation, the political conversation that presided over by the mainstream media, chooses to trivialize rather than to probe, chooses to talk about what's happened in the last 24 hours rather than to consider what's happened in the last two or three decades.
Andrew Bacevich is author of the book America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. Andrew is retired professor of history and international relations at Boston University. He served for 23 years as a commissioned officer in the United States Army. Andrew, we'd love to have you back on a panel to talk about solutions and where we go next. But thank you so much for your latest book, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Helena Murphy is our intern and researcher. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.